Editors of the Mount Greylock Echo student newspaper interview Bill Travis, the new superintendent.
Good morning. So we're here today with Dr. Travis, Issa St. Clair, Rachel Payne, and myself, Carl Kugler. And we're here to interview Dr. Travis for the Mount Greylock student newspaper, the Echo, and also for Willynet. So I guess to start off, Dr. Travis, is there anything about Mount Greylock that surprised you in the past 2 months or so that you've been here?
I don't know about surprise, but I've met with the School Building Needs Commission, and I've attended the presentation that the Williams College students did about the shortcomings of the building. And so I guess I was focused on some of the deficits in the building, and I think over the summer I've had a chance to see that, you know, confirm some of the things that really in a renovation or a new building what we'd like to look for. But I'm also surprised at how dirty and appropriate some of the space is in the building, and that's been a pleasant surprise.
What are you looking forward to as the school year approaches?
I think there are a lot of things I want to get a lot of information about. Part of it is what excites students about the school, what excites faculty about teaching, and to try to find ways to support and encourage those activities, and then find out what things people find as stumbling blocks. And one of the things that I hear repeatedly, and I have my own impressions, is that the rotating schedule presents a problem. The positives that I hear go in the direction of being able to see a student or a student seeing a faculty member at a different time of the day, and students and faculty are day people or afternoon people, and people maybe better present themselves better or do better in class at a different time of the day. I think that is far outweighed by the inconvenience it presents to students who may want to have opportunities beyond the four corners of a room with an activity that would be community service, college credit, a real job experience. And if you're going to do that for, let's say, the equivalent of 30 credits, you need to come back here and get specific academic courses. And so with a schedule that rotates, as you know, it would be tough to say, I'm going to go and take a class at 10 o'clock in the morning at MCLA or Berkshire Community College or Williams and return and know that I'm going to get English class in the afternoon. I really want to see how the rotating schedule works and really learn whether there are more advantages to it than appears to meet the eye right now.
So for this upcoming year, we'll still be rotating?
We're rotating, and that part of that is because of the teacher's contract and the way the work day is defined by the contract.
For several years now, various members of the school community have been rallying for block scheduling. Do you have any experience with that or any opinion on that possibility?
We've looked at it on a number of occasions in my previous job, and we've gone to a number of districts and observed a whole variety of block schedules. In some cases, it's the entire day is a block schedule. In others, it might be one or two courses that are blocked. So you might have an hour and a half for a science class or a math module. But everything else during the course of the day would then revert to a typical 45 or 50 minute period. And there are advantages and disadvantages of that. Obviously, with a longer time, with a science class in particular, you get in the lab, so you have time to set up an experiment, actually do it, take things apart, put everything away safely. And so there are real advantages there. What happens, though, is classes in social studies and English feel, well, I could use a writing lab for an extended period. Right. So what courses are you going to put into a block? So I think there are some attractive features about a block, but I don't know whether it advantages or disadvantages some departments. And so the smaller the school in terms of the number of students, the fewer options you have. So I want to look at a block before finding out that if you get into a block, you cut off electives. But there are some real advantages to giving kids extended time to think and work, and you can do a rough draft and then you can start to tear it apart and while you're thinking about it rather than drop it for the day and come back. The other advantage is that you almost end up with a college course. You could do a block 2 or 3 days a week and then do something else. So some blocks have been Tuesday and Thursday. The whole day might be a series of blocks, but Monday, Wednesday, and Friday you revert to 7 periods a day. Mm-hmm. So you might elect an art block on Tuesday and Thursday, but then your other classes would be 5 days a week around the block, but extended during a few of those days.
How do you plan to interact with students on a daily basis?
Well, I plan to be right by that front door in the morning. You know, you've got a sort of welcoming a new guest to your house. You know, I think you have to be out there and introduce yourself and get to know people. And after that, it would be like having another brother or sister in the house. Pretty soon they can open the door themselves and you don't have to be there. You can say, hi, how are you? And go on about your business. And so I treat this as a home. And I ought to be out there really getting to know students and the routine. And then as time goes on, I think that will, how I interact with students will change. I like to be in a lot of classrooms and observe what's going on so that I can find out, both from the comments that students make and from the comments that staff make about the things that really work and don't work about the school. So whether that's in the morning or at lunch in the cafeteria or after school for activities, whether that's theater, music, sports, I really would like to get out there and get to see kids. A school is more than just what goes on in a class. It's sort of how the kids interact with each other in the halls. What do they want to do for the school in terms of school spirit and other activities? So if you don't see things that go on in the evening or the afternoon or the weekends, you don't really know the whole student. So I want to get out there and see those things.
You mentioned the teacher contract briefly before. What do you see as the role of the teachers union in the relationship between like you and the Mount Greylock community?
Well, a union has a responsibility to take a look at the needs of the teachers in terms of their work day, their work expectations, so by having the right to organize and to discuss those issues, there's also then a group that the school committee and the administration can deal with in order to work issues out. So I think a union is an appropriate way to, rather than try to deal with 60 or 70 individuals, it offers some advantages to working through some officers on issues around school policy, on the school day, those things that also are closer to someone's heart, which is their salary and work day. And so I see an important role for the union to play.
I feel, and I think a lot of individuals in the school feel, that the relationship between Mount Greylock and Williamstown Lanes Road, just the towns that it serves, is not so great. I think the Echo and its broadcast are trying to bridge that gap, but there really isn't a lot of communication, and there's oftentimes tension. I think the town looks at Greylock as being very removed from the community, and at times when we need to pass an override to keep all of our courses intact, we really do need a good working relationship there. How do you think we can improve the relationship?
Well, a couple of parents that I met this summer had a very interesting observation. These parents happened to be people who had moved to Lanesboro or Williamstown within the last 6 years. And so they had some children who were in the elementary school and just at Greylock. Others came here with children who were already in the high school. And so they got involved, as parents will, with the activities. And they got to know other parents, some of whom had grown up in Williamstown and Lanesboro and had gone to Mount Greylock themselves. And they found, surprisingly, that a lot of these parents had never really been back at Mount Greylock, or their memory of Greylock was, oh, what a wonderful school, it doesn't need any improvements, look at the beautiful view, you drive by on Route 7 and gosh, everything must be absolutely wonderful there, and they hadn't been back on campus in a long time. And I think that says a lot about the school not really being in Williamstown and not easy for adults who don't have children or their children are grown and going through school to really think about the school and have it on their minds. And so I think it would be really good to find some ways of bringing back the alumni who still happen to live in the feeder towns. PTO had an idea, rather than a work day this year, that maybe we could have some kind of event in the fall and bring back, have the school do something for the community. So maybe we can do something as simple as having a softball game against the graduates of Greylock from the 90s versus the graduates of the 80s who are still around, you know, but bring them back so that they can actually see the campus, go through the building. Students possibly could help them. We could have a cookout or a bonfire or something to bring the parents or adults who don't have kids here back onto the campus and really have a look at it. But it also would be a way for Greylock to recognize that it has served these people well and can do something in return for them. So I think that's really tough. Physically, the further away you are, the more difficult it is to get your kids back to do things after school or to keep them here and get them home and do homework and I left the book and, you know, how do I get back to the locker to get the book out to do things? So there are other things that I plan to do, and that is to go to some school committee meetings for Lanesboro and for Hancock, even though it's and Williamstown, even though they're elementary schools. Many of those parents will be sending kids this way, or they have multiple children and they're bridging across. So I'd like to find a way that particularly Hancock and Lanesboro, maybe the elementary school can serve as a center for 7th through 12th graders as a place where if they need the library, books could be delivered there so it would be easier for parents to pick them up. It might be a place for offering tutoring so that a high school student that wants to mentor another student but lives in Hancock can meet the student there rather than travel back up here. Now in addition to that, the superintendents from Lanesboro, Hancock, and Williamstown and I are going to be meeting regularly to look at the program of studies for the elementary schools to see whether there are things that we can do to have a program of studies that would bring all kids into 7th grade with a more uniform program of studies background. And so that's one group that's going on. And there's also a study going on now to talk about whether the regions ought to be reconfigured and possibly come up with a K-12 region, whether that is just between Williamstown Elementary and Mount Greylock as a K-12 new district, or whether it ought to be a K-12 district involving Hancock and Lanesboro and Williamstown. So that's going on, and that has a lot of ramifications for you might only need one superintendent instead of three. But now you have a superintendent who's going to be responsible for elementary education as well as middle and high school education. So there's a lot of things for the communities to consider, but there might be some programmatic changes that having a K-12 district would bring about that might bridge some of the items that you raised in the Echo last year.
I hope some of that actually gets me.
I think there was an edge to part of the Echo's article that the gap was one of academics as well as one of sort of group dynamics among students. And part of that may be addressed in a study of the programs that actually occur in the elementary schools before students are seventh graders. So one of the other things we're thinking about is maybe bringing the sixth graders onto the Greylock campus during the course of this year. So all of a sudden they're not afraid of walking the halls, the idea that they're going to have a locker or they're not going to have a recess. We can dispel a lot of those things and bring kids in who might know each other a little bit in advance. So we're going to look at some possibilities of bringing the kids in, both to talk about the social getting together as friends or pen pals, as well as addressing the program of studies that kids will actually experience before they come to Greylock. So I think there are two aspects of what you unveiled in your article, and I think we need to address both. It's not just academics, and it's not just social interactions.
I would love to. I only wish I'd gone to some of the town meetings in Lanesboro to actually see their input. I mean, I saw the Lanesboro response in the paper, but I've never been to that elementary school. I have no idea how their elementary school differs from ours. I just do get the sense that they don't quite coincide, that we're not quite on the same page. But I'd love to hear what you guys come up with.
Actually, there's a meeting tomorrow night of the regionalization study at Lanesboro Elementary School at 7 o'clock, and there are actual appointed people from the different school committees who are there, and then the public is welcome. And,
yeah. Okay.
So,
that's
ongoing.
Thank you.
That's good. You mentioned, not today, but at other times, that you're against the user fees for athletics and extracurriculars and that sort of thing.
Well, if all things were equal, I would like to see the regular school committee budget cover those expenses. But when it comes between some user fees and keeping activities versus no user fees and only those activities that can afford to pay for themselves, I would rather see a universal activity fee. And I think that there are precautions. There's a procedure where anyone who feels that they can't afford the activity, they're either reduced costs or no cost. And so there are some protections for that. Having experienced user fees now for several years, I think there's a sense of ownership. Because I know, at least my experience has been, a number of students either take that money out of summer jobs or some other services provided in the family in order to come up with the money. And I think that might help them invest a little bit into the activity that they're in. So while I would like to see them go away, I think they are reasonably priced right now, and there are precautions for people who can't afford it.
I actually am wondering if you can elaborate a little bit more on sort of what you see as the financial challenges of the school going forward. As you know, there were some fiscal folks at Williams who did a fairly comprehensive study of the school's finances looking forward a few years, and I think projecting an assumption of no additional state aid, it looked fairly grim. And of course, the rubber will hit the road on that immediately in terms of whatever you can work out with the faculty union. But I guess I'm wondering whether you have any fresh insights as to how to tackle this school's finances and public education's finances generally.
Well, I attended the summer superintendent's conference, and there were some encouraging signs. There will be a slight increase in the Chapter 70 money that's distributed, probably on the order of about $50 per student that towns will see. And part of that is because of positive revenues in the state So there are new revenues coming in from taxes. So the economy is beginning to come back, and so that may change some of the projections, which seemed to be right on target a year ago or 18 months ago, that the state was still finding itself with a structural deficit. It may, in fact, be finding its way out of it. The other thing that's changing will be the way the state has borrowed lots of money for school projects. There will now be a 1% on the sales tax. 1% of the money collected for the sales tax will now be set aside for school renovation projects. And so the state won't find itself in borrowing literally billions of dollars for school projects. Those will be paid off, and now there'll be another system in place to help for school aid. So when the state doesn't have to borrow money, it has more money than to put into education. This is really the most positive way of looking at change. It's got to come from state and federal resources. The property tax is a very regressive way of trying to fund education. The other piece about that is that the state is playing with a formula which will look at the average income of a town as opposed to the average wealth of real estate. So all you have to do is pick up the newspaper and see there was an article today about somebody who just bought 60 acres of land in Williamstown for $1.5 million and wants to develop several houses, which will be very expensive. So the value of property in Williamstown and Lanesboro and Hancock is very high, but that doesn't match the incomes of the people who have lived there for 10, 20, 30 or more years. Their salaries don't match the value of their property if they were to sell or move. So if now we look at how much money Mount Greylock would be entitled to based on the average income of the communities, there may be more state aid coming to the district. And there's also talk today, there's going to be a constitutional convention in Massachusetts to address health care. And so the projections of 12 to 14% increases in the cost of health care may dramatically be affected by another type of insurance. And so that begins to pull down some of the real negative factors that were driving a budget to go out of whack in the Williams projections, and it may increase the revenue stream on the other side and pull those things together a little bit more. Now the school committee has a beautiful piece of property right here, and whether there are other uses that the property might afford that would generate some income, I don't know. Also in today's paper, seems to be rich in education news. Mount Everett High School had an auditorium that was the home for Barrington Stage Company, and now they have moved to a new location. But that generated a revenue of about $20,000 a year for the use of the stage in the summer when the school wasn't fully in use. And it might not be a bad idea to look at other uses for this property, either for conferences or some other activities that might generate some revenue. And depending on the source of the activity, those funds could go into, you know, dedicated areas to support the arts or support technology or support a particular program of studies. So there are some possibilities that might be explored that would be revenue generating just using the facility that exists.
I've got one other question that I'll recede in the background again, but on the question of the facilities, you know, you're sort of leading the question of what's happening in terms of the analysis of new building, renovate building, new location, stay here. How's that dynamic playing out so far in your mind with the school building committee, which is now meeting regularly?
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, they've gotten to the stage where they're putting out a proposal to have an architect come in and actually look at the evidence that's been gathered so far, pros and cons about the current status of the building and renovating versus a renovation with a small addition or a total renovation. So I think the committee has people with a great variety of backgrounds on it. Some architects, some engineers, some planners. The contribution of the Williams College students. I don't know if any of you saw the presentation that they made at the end of the year, but it was pretty neat. They put where the middle school is and where those middle school kids have to go for gym, for library, for lunch, and the amount of time that someone has to walk through a building. And then they looked at the high school use and the movement patterns. And so there are clearly a number of things that need to be addressed. But I think they got them all out on the table. So I think an architect now looking at the pros and cons that were developed, I think can advise the committee pretty well on next steps. Now, because of the value of the building, I think the first step in any process would be what can be done to renovate the existing facility. Then I think the second one is, can you renovate some of the facility and maybe through some construction make the kinds of improvements that would keep down the cost? And then the third would be a totally new building, but using the current real estate that the district has. And only if for some reason all three of those are a strikeout would you begin to look at building a facility someplace else. The cost of every one of those goes up. As you know, you can redo your own rooms with a little paint and some wallpaper. You can knock down a wall or add a window, and that's not as expensive as building a whole new room on your house. And it's far less expensive than building a brand new house for your family. So I think those are the same kinds of, when you look at this as a family of tax-paying communities, you would look at your own house and make those kinds of decisions first, I think. Can you repair what you have? If not, can you repair and add? If not, build new. And then can you afford, if you have to build new, does it make sense to do it someplace else?
When you talk about renovation, are you thinking, you know, 5 to 10 years down the line when our economic condition is stabilized a little bit, or is the condition of the school bad enough that we need immediate action?
Well, part of that is generated by the state moving to a new way of funding school projects. So I think and no community can afford to do this all by themselves. And the old formula for renovating schools, every community was eligible for a certain percentage of the cost to be paid for by the state. And so in some communities it was 60%. Some communities, Pittsfield, renovated its schools and got 68% back. More disadvantaged communities got 90% back because locating a school might solve other problems like breaking up communities that cause students to be racially forced into certain schools, as opposed to if I locate a school here, maybe I can draw people from a number of communities. In order to desegregate your schools like that, the state would pay 90% of the cost of rebuilding. So there are about 300 school projects that yet have to be paid for and completed and paid for before new projects will go on the state list. So I see the chances of doing anything significant being at least 3 or 4 years down the road. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have the plans in place and get those approved, and then you go on a list, and then as school projects are funded, your number moves down that list. So it would be prudent to decide what we want to do, find out how much reimbursement the district would be entitled to, and then plan that way. Now, in the meantime, do windows have to be replaced to be more energy efficient? Does wiring for the internet have to go on to keep it up with pace? And if you spend the thousands of dollars that would entail, could you either reuse it in a renovated facility so that you could sort of wrap it all up and take it with you? Mm-hmm. So there are a number of costs like that may be, for some people, renovation that could proceed just using the local tax base as it is. Doesn't anybody want to ask about the water?
It's on the list.
Yeah.
Sure. What's the status of the water station?
I have no idea. No, actually, there have been a number of meetings over the course of the summer looking at a possible solution. And right now, the most likely arrangement would be using wells that are on the property owned by the nursing home. And we're exploring the mechanics of getting water to the school, how to monitor the quality of the water, and making arrangements to be sure that if we were to have this arrangement with the nursing home, that they have all the water for their current and future needs, so that this isn't something where you invest a lot of money and get it started for a year or two and then find that you have to undo it. So I think we have in concept something that the nursing home and they're owned by Northern Berkshire Health Systems, which is basically North Adams Regional Hospital. So in concept, they're willing to work out an arrangement. The school committee is willing to use the money that we got from the state to help come up with a permanent solution for the water problem. And now we're looking at how does that happen and guarantee the protections for the school committee side, that the arrangement would be long-term, and for the nursing home and the hospital, that they have adequate resources for the future. And so I hope that those talks are coming to a good conclusion very quickly, so that maybe by the end of September even there would be a permanent solution in place.
If I could just ask you briefly, considering all the problems that we've been discussing, what made you decide to want to come to Mount Greylock in the first place?
Well, you know, when you put all of those problems aside, and as you get to live in another community, you find that there are problems of different, they're just of different types. Mm-hmm. Then you start looking at the strengths. And one of the things I have wanted to do for a very long time is to get back in closer touch with faculty and students. And I couldn't think of a better place than Greylock, given both its size. I was a junior high school and a high school teacher, so it fits my background as opposed to an elementary school. So it had a lot of things that attracted me. I could get closer in touch with working on program of studies. Problems are going to be almost anywhere, and I have the advantages of getting back in touch with faculty and students.
Thanks. Can I, like, completely change the subject, or does anyone else have anything on that? Okay. Well, currently, students are allowed to waive gym class in either their senior or their junior year. However, in the past, students with, like, really rigorous academic schedules, for example, if they were taking two or more APs, have been allowed to waive it for both years. What are your thoughts on gym waivers?
Well, one only has to take a look at the health of Americans in general to know that kids are, and adults, are heavier, more sedentary, and without some type of regular, rigorous activity. And the activity, I think, that's appropriate is something that provides for some lifelong sense of one's well-being. And I think the fact that Greylock really calls their program a wellness program speaks to the kinds of activities that kids are engaged in. It's not just basketball. And when you're my age, I might have played basketball in high school and college, but I'd be a little slow on the court these days. So that's not a lifelong activity. But there are other things. So I think there's a real role for physical activity in any program. And the reason other districts have less of it than Greylock is because, frankly, of budget cuts. And they have less music and less art. And those are the activities that people have found easier to eliminate. Sort of the reverse is true in a smaller school district. Having physical education classes available in all 4 years has a place to put students when their schedule built around their other courses. You can put a student into physical education and the class size can grow because of the types of activities that kids are engaged in. So, in one sense, the requirement is here because it fills an important role in the overall schedule for students. So when there are exceptions because of someone's academic program, finding an alternative, what are you going to give up in place of it? I still think you'll find that Greylock students have more physical activity than most students in other middle and high schools, where they have physical education 2 or 3 times a week only. And so I think there are good grounds to have trade-offs. But I also don't think that any school system, if it had its full funding capabilities, would ever do away with a rigorous program of activities for kids to get involved in.
This again is a complete change of subject, but I'm under the impression that, let's see, we do 990 hours of education here, and isn't that like the bare minimum required by the state, like of hours in a school year? In your opinion, is that the best way for Greylock to go, to be doing that bare minimum? Is there any reason that we might want to add hours to the school day?
Well, when you look at the expectations for your generation, both for the type of skills you're going to need in the future, I think it speaks volumes about the need for a different instructional program. Whether that's a longer day or a longer year, I think it's going to be coming. All of that costs money. And so the trade-off now is how can a local community pay for that additional time? And that's the real drawback. I think that every student ought to have 4 years of science, and it'll be rigorous science, and they're going to have 4 years of math, and you don't have 4 years of math here. A lot of kids take 4 years of math, but it's not a requirement. But whenever you do that, I think you have to realize that students grow and mature at different rates, and so you need to have alternative ways to get there. So whether that's a 200-day school year for some students, so that they can take maybe one less course and go on a tri-semester rotation or a summer program, or they can get there because they want to do some community service and will give up a class and go a longer school year. There's no reason why students have to view high school as something that you complete in 4 years. It could be 5 years, it could be 3 years, depending on, you know, let's say a student with a real involved academic program might want to take 8 subjects and use that extra 200 days or another study period to get that 8th course in, and therefore get out of here in 3 years. And others may want to slow that down. Either they need to, or because of other choices they like to explore, they want to. So I think it's going to come, but it's going to cost money.
So I think when it comes, it'll be the state making some sort of legislation. It won't be our independent choice.
I don't see the economics going along with a longer day or a change in the kind of programs that students have. You have to either hire faculty with new skills if you're going off in a new direction, or you're going to have to hire additional faculty in order to cover all of the new periods of instruction. And so that's going to cost immediate money. And I don't see that coming out of the way education is funded right now. You could take a percentage of what this country is spending on the war right now and put it into education and look at the competition that you are all going to have as you grow up and become responsible citizens, as war is not the right term, but as definite competition from countries all around the world. I think we have to put more resources in your hands, and we're not able to do that right now.
I read in the Berkshire Eagle a couple of days ago that the Massachusetts Department of Education has made a proposal to increase the length of the school day by 30%, and they're giving out a very few grants. Are you considering applying for that? What do you think about that?
Well, it was one of the things that we learned about at the superintendent's conference this summer. One thing that the article didn't really go into was the fact that the grants are really going to be targeted towards urban districts that have a number of underperforming schools. And these are schools where it's very difficult to even have the required minimum number of math classes in order to do well on the MCAS test. So you'll have a number of students who will go through some schools with business math, really arithmetic, maybe Algebra 1 by the time they're 10th or 11th graders, and not have any exposure to geometry, Algebra 2, let alone trigonometry. And as you know from your own experience with the MCAS test, questions like that are on there. So as a result, middle schools and high schools are falling into the underperforming category. And so the thought is that with a longer school day, you could now add a math module and have a required 3 or 4 years of math. So you'd need extra time, either in the length of the day or the length of the school year, in order to get those extra courses in. So the money right now is really going to those districts that really need the time in order to bring students up to the current testing expectations and let them play with the schedule. And the money is really going to an elementary school with a middle school. Can we expand the day so that whenever we make those changes, it'll be over a number of years, so those elementary kids will move into the middle school, and so they both have a longer day or longer year, and they fit together. Or the grant will go to a middle school and a high school, so that the feeder school will affect the high school schedule for a number of years to come, not just a single school playing with the day going longer or going more days in the year. So the first steps are going to be taken by urban districts, the Lowells, the Holyokes, the Bostons. That's really where the first round of that grant money is going to go.
On that note, where do you see the future of extended learning?
Well, right now, the extended learning minutes, when you add it up, come up with the 990 minutes. So my own druthers is that the first thing we ought to look at is converting that extended time into the time for the current seven periods. I like the concept of an extended learning period, but I don't know, and that's what one of the things I'll experience as I go through this first year. I don't know that it serves students or faculty well the way right now it rotates, and students can take advantage of it for additional help or studying as they choose, but it I'm not sure that that use, as opposed to academic instruction under the direction of a faculty member, is the best use of the time. Now, if there were 990 minutes plus an extended period, and that sort of gets to a longer day or a longer year, I think that time would be very valuable. I'd love to see the library used at the end of school for homework help, and maybe staff it with students who are willing to help other students, and we could use email or the internet to post homework assignments so that students who came in there and needed the extra help could, you know, make sure they had their work, and whoever was going to tutor could see the assignments as well and help out. So if that were built into the day and you could get students home with transportation and so on, that would be a wonderful extension of the day.
If we were to go that way, would that really be such an expense? Because aren't teachers being paid for 90 hours of real teaching as it is, and they're not teaching during that additional 30 minutes? So if they were to teach through extended and then we tacked on those extra 30 minutes, where would the expense be except for keeping like the library open, for example?
Well, it disrupts a number of things, not the least of which is transportation.
Yeah.
And the buses, as you know, that pick students up here at Greylock then have to get the kids home and be at the elementary schools to pick up students there and do a second run. So just saying, well, we can add on 30 minutes at the end of the day, it means that kids in the elementary school aren't being picked up and brought home. So there are a lot of other things that cross into the course of the day that need to be addressed before just looking at that as a solution. Now, the other thing is looking at, like, the athletic schedule, a longer day, even if the school were to start later. And I know high school kids like to sleep in, and elementary kids are having breakfast and turning on the computer or the television or reading at 6 o'clock in the morning. They're ready to go. So why not just flip the times? Well, one of the problems is when you have an athletic program and you count on daylight for your outdoor activities, whether that's the fall or the spring, then time for practice and travel and competition and so on, it makes that very difficult to do. And it would be easier if there were several high schools that would do it at the same time, so that you could, whatever the alternative is, either playing under lights or a modified schedule, then everyone's doing it the same. So just an extended day for us would cause some real problems for students involved in those kinds of activities too.
I've got another question, if I may. You mentioned in passing a few minutes ago the cost of our military involvements and what that might do in education. In your experience in Pittsfield, can you talk a little bit about how you have managed the relationship between military recruiters and the school, and whether that's any different in how it's handled here, and whether you think it is appropriate for a school district to allow counter recruiters equal access to students?
As you know, the requirement came about because of the federal legislation in No Child Left Behind. And basically, a school district can't take federal money without providing a list of student names and addresses, so that that can be made specifically available to military recruiters or other government purposes. And Greylock gets in excess of $200,000. Pittsfield got in excess of $4 million in federal dollars. So you can't turn those dollars aside, and you sort of buy that requirement. Prior to No Child Left Behind, I think the relationship with military recruiters was one where they were welcome just as any other college placement office coming and doing an information session. They had a place in the guidance, and they would post that the Marine Corps was going to interview students, and they'd be available in the guidance, you know. And by the way, Amherst College and Berkshire Community College were going to be, you know, there the following day or an hour later, and they came in just as anybody else. I think the thing that a number of people find wrong with the current thing is that now that address list is something that has to be released. Now, you're advised in your student handbook, and parents are advised that they can remove your name from that list. But you have to actively go out and do it, and that's, you know, not on the top of everyone's mind. And so, by default for some people, and consciously wanting that information to go out for others, that goes out. So, my own sense is that the military, under those circumstances, has sort of a free ride. They automatically can come in, as opposed to saying, well, I've got 10 high schools in Berkshire County, and, you know, I can hit 2,000 students in one day if I went to two high schools in Pittsfield, as opposed to 500 students if I went to Mount Greylock. They might make a decision just like a college would and say, well, here are the demographics of the type of students we're attracting. It would be, I could hit 2,000 students by going to two high schools in Pittsfield as opposed to. So someone isn't making that decision anymore. They've got the names of kids. They can call, they can write, they can mail, and they can also come on campus. And I think it's that disadvantage that a number of people object to. Having said that, I don't know that there's any reason not to let anyone make an appointment who wants to talk to students, who has something that they have, a program that students can sign up for. I think kids need to be informed and make wise choices, and one of the ways you learn about that is to actually experience it. My sense with counter recruiters is really what I read about in the paper, as opposed to any particular initiative or effort. So, as opposed to getting students down and not being able to offer them anything in particular, I don't know what there is, what that counter-recruiter thing is. So I think it's the kind of thing you have to experience and meet and see what a particular group might want to offer. Everyone else has something that has a career decision that a student can make. So if someone wants to come in for the Peace Corps, or someone wants to come in for Habitat for Humanity or something like that as an alternative, I think that would be a fair group to post opportunities and let students come in and see them.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. I look forward to getting this year underway and beginning to interact with.
Should be a good year.
Folks like you.